I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Salim Haddad, is an aid worker and now a novelist. His new book, Guapa, is the story of Raza, a translator living in a Middle Eastern country in the throes of unrest. He lives with his fierce grandmother, who sees him with his lover, Tamor, by spying through the keyhole of his bedroom door. This event sets the stage for the next tense 24 hours as Raza relives pivotal moments in his life, searches for his best friend Maj, a fearless drag queen arrested by the police, confronts long-buried family secrets, and comes to terms with his sexuality. Guapa is the name of a popular bar frequented by Raza and his friends. Salim Haddad joins us to talk about his book and the complexities of queer life in the Middle East. He said in an interview that gays in the Arab world are seen as helpless victims by Western media and sick deviants are agents of the West by Arabic media. He was born in Kuwait, educated in Jordan, Canada, and the UK where he lives. He's an aid worker and he's worked with Doctors Without Borders, among other groups. And Salim Haddad, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So what did this grandmother see when she peered through the keyhole of Raza's bedroom door?
Well, we don't really know, do we?
We don't.
Neither does Raza. He just knows that she saw something. And I think even for a long period in the novel, he's not even sure if she did see something or whether she was just suspecting.
Why did she look? I mean, do you think, I mean, you created her. Why did she look through the keyhole?
Well, I think she's, and I think, you know, Arab women of that generation are fascinating to me, which is why I wrote a character based on one of them. But I think she feels like she needs to know everything. And her idea of what is private and what is public is very different than Raza, who is much younger, and his idea of private and public. So for her, looking through a keyhole of a closed door into her grandson's bedroom is completely
perfectly okay. It's her apartment.
After all, it is her apartment.
Even if it's his bedroom, it's her apartment.
Exactly, and that's what she reminds him.
Tell us about her, and then I'll have you do a reading from the book. This grandmother. It's funny, in my introduction, I originally wrote tyrannical, and then as I was chatting with you before going on the air, I changed tyrannical to fierce. Tell us about this grandmother.
So this grandmother, Teta, who is very much based on my own grandmother, who I am very close to, she is very typical of a certain type of woman of her generation who has been raised and grown up and lived through a certain type of Arab patriarchy for so long. And so in many ways, she's internalized a lot of these lessons. But she gets to a point when she is old enough that she simply doesn't care anymore. And she begins to exert her own power and becomes a bit of a matriarch. And, you know, I've seen women like this throughout the Middle East, and my grandmother is one of them. And, you know, and I've grown up under the shadow of one of these women. And so I have this reverence for this type of female character. And I really wanted to show how patriarchy can affect women in ways that might not necessarily be very obvious. You know, the standard idea of how women are oppressed in the region gives the sense of a submissive Arab woman. And I wanted to explore the impact of patriarchy through actually a very strong and domineering woman character.
So is tyrannical the wrong word for her?
I think there's an
From
element
your perspective.
Of her. I think there's an element of her that is definitely tyrannical, but there's also an element of hers that, of her that is. I think the tyranny is driven by, you know, her intense desire to protect Raza and her love for him and her idea of protecting him from all the dangers in society.
The book begins with the sentence, "The morning begins with shame," and this is Raza's shame, realizing that his grandmother has peeked through the keyhole, seen him in bed, or thinks seen him in bed with another man.
Yeah.
Shame.
Shame. And shame is a huge part in the novel. And I've always been interested in exploring the idea of shame. It's played a big part in my own life and my own upbringing. You know, shame is a way to police people's behavior in the Middle East, and it was a way that would police my own behavior, my own masculinity, so I really wanted to examine that.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, which is, in many ways, is about this shame that Raza feels.
Okay. Taimur's name is embargoed under a cloak of aib. The closest word for aib in English is perhaps shame, but aib is so much more than that. The implication of aib is kalam al-nas, what people will say. And so the word carries an element of conscientiousness, a politeness brought about by a perceived sense of communal obligation. Aib is an old cloak that Teta draped across my shoulders many years ago. After Baba's death, she wove an intricate web for the two of us. In public, we were stoic, navigating social obligations like pros. When it was just us, unspoken words rotted in our mouths. Teta hid her grief behind a pinched nose, a tight smile, and her ever-growing list of aibs. It's aib not to go visit the neighbors during Eid. It's aib to miss a wedding, even if you hate every minute of it. It's aib to pick your nose in public. Accepting a second helping of food on the first offer? Aib. Shoo, I don't feed you enough? It's aib to ask a woman how old she is, or to ask someone what religion they are. It's aib for a young boy to play with Barbie dolls. I've come to realize that if worn correctly, the cloak of aib is large and malleable enough to allow you to conceal many secrets and to repel intrusive questions. For example, it's aib to ask me my girlfriend's name if I don't offer it to you first. I suppose because of this secrecy, Taimur's name holds an unexplainable power over me. It's a name weighed down by secrets and implications, transformed into something much larger than its seven letters. I look forward to listening to people say the name with their unique inflections and tones. I analyze it, I spell it out. Sometimes I even whisper his name out loud when I can be certain nobody can hear. This satisfies me for some time, but it's never enough. No, I need others to say his name too. It makes the name real. It makes us real.
That's our guest, Salim Haddad, reading from his novel called Guapa. I mean, even the word, certainly in English, shame, is so shameful. I mean, there is something about just the way it sounds, mm-hmm. sounds like what it is. But there's also, as you write, something intriguing and forbidden that's buried in these shameful things.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And, I mean, I'm very interested in understanding how shame as a concept can be malleable and open to subversion. And that's something that I was interested in doing in the novel, was explore characters who subvert the idea of what is and isn't shameful in order to make a room for themselves in their communities. But I'm also interested in the political implication of this on a broader level, especially when it comes to LGBT rights in the region, as another angle of LGBT pride, for example, is exploring also how we can expand the notion of shame in order to make room for queer people in Arab societies.
Also, one of the characters says that I guess being gay or even living with some of these secrets requires an Oscar-winning performance. I mean, to be able to sort of pretend otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that, to me, was the hardest part growing up. It was the performance of it. And, you know, when you get to a certain, or at least when I got to a certain level, I was tired of performing, and I didn't want to do it anymore. So when people often say, you know, especially, you know, in Europe or the U.S., or your life must have been under threat, I often say, well, it's not really that simple. It's more that I was sick of performing.
Uh-huh.
And many of my friends live very happy lives in this performance. And, you know, they're able to do this dance, this social dance, very well. I'm not one of them.
And the social dance is what, pretending otherwise? Or when someone says, are you getting married? You say yes, or maybe you even do get married.
You say inshallah.
Inshallah.
God
right.
willing. Yeah.
Yes. Right. As part of that performance.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have a friend of mine who has sadly passed away now, but he is gay, and he comes from a very conservative family in Lebanon, and he got married to a lesbian, and it was a huge performance. But they got married for their parents. Their parents were very happy. They then moved to the Gulf and lived together as housemates, you know, this amazing life. And they, for them, there was no... ambiguity there. It was very clear that there was, you know, the public life, and then there was the private life, and the public performance of it.
Do you think that's, I mean, I think all people have a public and private performance and life, certainly true in this country. Do you think it's any more true in the Middle East?
I think the stakes are much higher in the Middle East, and that's the difference. I think in the Middle East, there's a lot more to lose. If you don't play the game or don't dance the dance.
Because it's a crime to be gay?
I think in some cases it's a crime. In some countries it's a crime to be gay, and in some countries there are no gay laws. But I think, and for me the very difficult part, and this links to the broader element and why I wanted to explore the Arab revolutions in the context of this novel, is because I find, you know, queer lives and the challenges queer people face to be intricately tied to the broader struggle for accountability, proper implementation of laws, the ability to speak out, and the fight for sort of freedom and dignity that the Arab Spring initially exemplified.
And part of that Arab Spring, were there sort of embedded in the calls for more freedoms, the freedom to be gay, to be out and gay in the Middle East?
No. I worked a lot after the Arab revolutions in Egypt and Yemen and Libya, speaking to a lot of youth activists and women activists, because we were doing work around transitional and peace processes. And the question of gay rights didn't come up. Even women's rights was a contested field. And I think when there were flourishes of gay rights activism within the context of the broader revolutions after 2011, they were quickly brushed aside as not a priority at the moment.
You write, or Argus Raza is saying here, what's the point of risking your life to remove a mask only to wear a different one? That would be like castrating donkeys. I circled that because I don't know that phrase about castrating donkeys. But I was intrigued by the first part as well, which is if you're not fighting for your rights, whose rights are you fighting for?
Mm-hmm. So the castrating donkeys phrase was when I was living in Jordan, and this was, you know, over 10 years ago now, I was riding in a taxi, much like Rasa did, and the taxi driver was very frustrated, and he said, you know, life these days feels like castrating donkeys.
Wow.
And I just really loved that phrase. So for, you know, 11 years, that phrase was sitting in my head until I found the perfect opportunity to use it in this book.
But the idea of a mask.
The idea of a mask, I think... You know, I wrote this novel while I was doing a lot of work around the Arab Spring. And initially when the protests first started in Tunisia and Egypt, I just remember feeling this overwhelming wave that, you know, our time had finally come and we were finally making our voices heard and we didn't have to act anymore. And, you know, as the year progressed, it was amazing for me to meet with all of these different types of Arab activists, you know, and I realized how small my world had been. And, you know, after years of not talking to one another, we were finally talking and we realized we didn't agree. And that was a very heartbreaking recognition. We thought it would be so easy that we would go out in the streets and we all had the same idea of what the future would bring. And finally, you know, after being united against something, we finally realized that we were actually fighting for different things. And so I think that's the struggle that Ras is talking about.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Salim Haddad, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's now a novelist. He's got a new novel. His first book is called Guapa. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Salim Haddad about his debut novel called Guapa, about the 24 hours in the life of a young Arab man named Raza. He's gay. And after being caught with his lover in bed by his grandmother, the story is about the political and religious upheavals after the Arab Spring. It's about shame and secrets and Raza's coming to terms with his own identity. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Guapa is not an Arabic word. It's actually a Spanish word. And this is this bar, this place where Raza and his friends hang out. Describe this place and why it's such a central part of this story.
In the Middle East, most young people, if not all young people, live with their parents until a very late age, until they get married. And so they don't often have a private space in their house. So it's really coffee shops and bars that are one of the few places where where young people can be themselves. And growing up in the Middle East, I remember having such a strong love for these bars and coffee shops. because it was really one of the few places, if not the only places, where I could walk in and feel that I was, you know, I was in a safe space. So I wanted, you know, this book about someone who's really trying to find his place in the world to have at its center point a bar like this that does allow him to be himself.
Are we talking gay bars? Or are we just talking bars where young people can congregate? Or does it matter?
I think it doesn't matter. I think a lot of these bars are bars where, you know, outcasts meet, and whether they're gay or whether they're political activists or whether they're simply sort of very outspoken women or feminists. I mean, these spaces are very politically important spaces. Mm. And so I think it transcends simply being gay.
There's a scene in the novel where Raza, he's a young boy and he's in a cab. He's put into a cab to go back to his home, mm-hmm. where his grandmother lives. And he becomes intrigued and interested with this cab driver who, and I don't know, did he sexually assault him? Was it consensual? Was Raza the victim here? Was he a curious young boy? I struggled with trying to figure out whether this was, I mean, it was clearly an important event that happened to him, and mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out whether he was hurt by it or not. Mm.
And when I wrote that, I wasn't even aware of the issues with it, because Raza was underage at the time that it happened. And it wasn't until my cousin had read a draft and she said, he was molested. And I thought, oh, I didn't even think of it that way. Because I was writing it from the perspective of Raza, who had, you know, just turned 13 and was just slowly discovering his sexuality. And so when I was writing it, I didn't see him necessarily as a pure victim. I feel that he was exploring this idea and he wasn't really sure himself how he felt right. about the event.
Which leads to the obvious question, which is, I mean, at what point in your life did you either realize you were gay or think you were gay? Was it a process for you?
It was definitely a process, and it was a very long process. You know, I grew up in the Middle East, and you don't really see gay characters on television, or you don't read about them. And, you know, even at the time, I was watching a lot of American television, but in the 90s, you know, there were very few gay characters on even American television. So I didn't really have these role models or really anything to build my identity on. And I remember thinking when I was very young that it was a death sentence, and, you know, I would...
Really?
I would, yes, much like Raza himself says that, you know, he just felt that the only thing he could do was get married because it would please his family and live this life, sort of.
A double life or a kind of a shrunken life?
A very shrunken life and a very unhappy life. And when I went to Canada for university, I thought it was my opportunity to really explore my sexuality. But, it, you know, I arrived a few weeks before September 11th happened, and I suddenly discovered that actually there was this whole other identity that I had no idea existed, which is this Arab identity. Because after all, you know, growing up in the Middle East, everyone is an Arab, so you don't really understand anything about your Arab identity. But I was suddenly exposed to it in a very different way. And so funnily, it wasn't until I went back to the Middle East that I really felt I had the space to explore my gay identity and meet other people and go to bars like Guapa. And that was really how I began to come out.
Well, and I wonder whether, like Raza, leaving the Middle East, going somewhere else, in this case, he goes to America and then comes back, you begin to see things that perhaps were there, but you didn't recognize were either gay people or gay bars or a gay life.
Exactly.
You write, I'd come to America preparing myself to be like a character on those television shows. I was going to be Blossom's best buddy. I was going to have a coffee shop gang like in Friends. More than that, America was going to offer me the space to examine myself in something clearer than the foggy mirror in Teta's bathroom. But as you said, or as he says in this book, but what you confronted was something completely new mm-hmm. and different, your Arabness. Mm-hmm. So this was after September 11th. For you,
yes.
In Canada, I guess.
In Canada, yes. And it was, and this is something that's for a lot of Arabs of my age and a bit younger, you know, September 11th was a huge part of our identity. It was a way for us to understand our Arabness and our Muslimness in a completely different way. So I really felt that September 11th was a key part of Rasa's own mm-hmm. identity. and his way of understanding his identity.
In what way?
I think it's, for many of us, you know, before 9/11, we took this Arab identity or this Muslim identity for granted. And after 9/11, I think we suddenly understood how, especially Western media, because I don't want to say Westerners in general, but Western media really picked up on a lot of elements that we had maybe not really considered, you know, things like, oh, well, how do you treat women? It's terrible. Or you know, even how do you treat gay people? And, you know, you had this feeling that you were suddenly being picked apart, picked at from the inside, all of these things that you didn't really know or you didn't really think too much about. And so your own sense of self is then informed by all of these criticisms that others are making of yourself. And that can be quite traumatizing.
Were these legitimate criticisms to say, well, how do you treat gay people? How do you treat women?
I think perhaps some of them, definitely. But I think, and the challenge is that a lot of it lacked nuance. And, you know, and I wrote about this in my article in the Daily Beast about the challenges of even writing a queer Arab story when you're dealing with all of these different discourses. You know, you're battling oppressive forces within your own community,
right,
but you're also battling, you know, this wider global media that tries to use this oppression for political goals.
I mean, how do you resolve that if you're kind of living in the middle of it?
I think it's hard, and you know, and the Daily Beast article, I think, is my way of just saying, you know, writing the novel was my way to try and make sense of it. And even after having written the novel, I feel I'm closer to understanding it, but I'm not there. Yeah. I think it's a process.
You also wrote in that Daily Beast article about some degree of reluctance, for your family's sake, for writing this novel. I don't know, were you outing them by writing a novel about a young gay man?
I don't think I was outing them, but I think my family still live in the Middle East. I mean, I spend half my time in the Middle East and half my time in London, but I now also have a foreign passport. And I realize that that offers me an element of protection that my family don't have. Having said that, I don't think that they're under any threat. But it was, you know, it's always the vulnerability to any threat.
Yeah. The book is dedicated for Rosette Batish, Teta, your Teta.
My Teta.
And your mother as well.
Yes.
And these are two really central characters in this novel.
Absolutely. And they are, you know, I come from a family of very strong women. And they're strong in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And so this novel, I realized while I was writing it that it was a celebration of some of these women.
Yeah.
And an analysis of some of these very interesting women in my life.
And have they read it?
Well, my mother has read it, yes.
What does she think?
I think she, in the beginning, when she first tried reading it, she struggled. And I think it was because she took a lot of it very personally. And it was a matter of telling her, you know, you are not the mother in
right.
this book.
And we should say, that, without giving too much away, the mother leaves.
The mother leaves, exactly.
Leaves the family.
The mother leaves the family.
Or leaves her son.
She has, you know, mental health issues and problems with alcoholism, which my mother doesn't have. So I think for my mother, it was a bit shocking at first. And I had to, you know, explain to her, this is fiction.
Yeah.
You know, I've taken, you know, an element or a conversation that we might have had and then just dramatized it to you know, make a point.
Was she okay with that?
And then she was okay. And then she read it again. And I think she told me she cried a lot and she found it very difficult because, you know, the main character is really struggling and she couldn't help but see her son struggling through all of this. And she said, well, where was I when all of this was happening? But the truth is my mother, you know, was always, and this is why the book is dedicated to her, is because she, when I first came out to her, she did struggle, but she always was always there. You know, she said, this is very difficult. But I think like what Teta says at some point to Rasa in the book, my mother said, you know, I'm just worried because who's going to take care of you when you're older? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that bothers me.
And how about your Teta?
My Teta has not read it. She knows that I have written a book and that she's a character in the book. She doesn't speak English or read English. So she's very happy. I've told her, you know, people in America think that your character is very interesting and many of them like you. And she seems very proud about that. But I don't think she's very interested in knowing what it's about. But it could also be that she knows exactly what it's about and she just doesn't want to ask.
Oh, interesting. let me just go. Sort of like Teta looking through the keyhole,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Salim Haddad is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's worked for a number of years as an aid worker, including for Doctors Without Borders and other organizations as well. And he's written a novel. It's called Guapa, G-U-A-P-A. And joining us on Radio Times to talk about some of the characters and things that happen in this novel, a bit about his life as well. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read. We have an email from Mark. He says, I'm a gay man who grew up in the Middle East, and I immigrated to the U.S. 4 years ago. For the love of my family, I've made the personal decision to live a life of celibacy but remain open about my gay identity. This is because my family, culture, and religion matter more to me than being in a same-sex relationship. I also find the Western set of expectations to be too self-centered. I want to get Salim's thoughts on my choice. Interesting. I mean, a different choice than what your character makes in this.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, for me, the most interesting part of that email was Mark's idea that practicing his sexuality was against his culture and his religion. And I don't know if he said family, but,
yes.
You know, for me, I think that is an often misunderstood concept. And I don't want to go into religion because I'm actually not that interested in what different religions have to say about homosexuality. It was never of interest to me.
Right.
I'm more interested in society and what society and how society deals with sexualities. And I think when you look back at history, homosexuality in the Arab world has a very long and rich history, you know, going back to Islamic and pre-Islamic times, where people were writing poetry, like men were writing poetry about other men, and I wouldn't say it's alien to the culture, and I think this is something that we need to really work hard to challenge. And this is oftentimes now in contemporary times, it's used against gay activism, saying it's alien to our culture, but it is not alien to our culture. It is one of the oldest elements of our culture.
There's a character in this novel, Maj. Am I saying that correctly?
Maj, yeah.
Maj, and I said a fearless drag queen. Mm-hmm. I mean, and she's arrested by the police, or Maj is arrested by the police. But did you have a Maj in your life?
I did have a Maj in my life. And the Maj character is made up of many friends that I really drew strength and inspiration from growing up, you know, in terms of helping me come to terms with my own identity. Not just my own sexual identity, but my political identity as well. And so Maj is drawn from all of these different people.
I was also reading that there was, I guess during Ramadan or something, a character, perhaps it was a TV show, Sherihan around the world. I don't know if this was just a woman that looked like a drag performer or whether this was an actual drag performer, but obviously intrigued you.
Yes, so growing up, Sherihan, she is a singer, an actress, and a dancer. She's a performer, and she would stage these shows on television during Ramadan. She's not a drag queen; she's a woman, but she was just so fabulous and so camp and so self-aware. And she would just stage these really intricate performances with dance costume, with different costumes and dance routines. And I remember growing up thinking, I want to be like you when I grow up. So I feel in a way that she's sort of like she planted the seed of my gay identity. And, you know, that's another testament that, you know, we have gay icons and we have queer icons in the Arab world. And so, you know, it is a part of our culture.
Maj is arrested by the police. And I should say there's a lot of chaos around their checkpoints. There are people getting arrested. There's violence. Things feel very unsettled. But Maj just is, as I said, is fearless, it seems, in the face of what's going on.
Yes. I think Maj has a lot of courage. I mean, he's got a tattoo along his collarbone that says, if you won't let us dream, we won't let you sleep. And so he's dedicated, you know, he's grown up being bullied, but he always sort of took pride in being bullied. So in a way, when, you know, he would play on people bullying him as a way to expose the hypocrisies of society or even play on ideas of masculinity. So this very subversive character, I think, is, yeah, he was he was a very interesting character to write.
Because he's so defiant, right?
Because he's so defiant, and because he represents this very powerful figure for me, and this sort of potential for change in the region. And I wanted to have a character that would inspire others.
Who's a drag queen.
Who's a drag queen, yeah.
In the beginning, you write something that Theodore Adorno has said, it is part of morality not to be at home in one's home, which is very provocative. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that? What does that mean to you?
Well, the way that I understood that quote and why I wanted to put it at the beginning of my book is Rasa spends a lot of time not feeling at home and questioning himself for all of these feelings that he's feeling. And so I think after having written the book, and I grew up in much the same way, I questioned my social class, I questioned my government, the governments that I was living under, I questioned society and society's views of sexuality. And because I've always felt like an outsider, both because my parents moved around a lot, but also because of my sexuality, I always had this distance from society. And that also troubled me, that distance. So that quote was a way for me to say, actually, there's an element of morality in questioning your own community and your own society.
And not being, in a sense, comfortable in your own surroundings.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, talking with Salim Haddad. He has a debut novel, I should say. It's called Guapa, and that's what we've been talking about in this hour of Radio Times, also talking about a bit about his life growing up in the Middle East. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Salim Haddad. He was born in Kuwait. He grew up in Cyprus and Jordan. He's the son of a Lebanese-Palestinian father and a German-Iraqi mother. Went to college in Canada, lives in England, has worked as an aid worker, and is now a novelist. We're talking about his debut novel, and it's called Guapa. 1-888-477-9499. I'd love to have you do another reading, and this is Raza, your main character, writing a letter to his lover, Taimur.
Okay. Habibi Taimur, I know you don't like me to call you that, to call you Habibi, but if there's one thing I can do so, if there's one time I can do so, let it be in this letter, which you can burn after reading if you wish. No one will ever know that you are my Habibi, and you are, whether you like it or not, my Habibi. I want to write to you because I do not know if you'll let me speak to you again after last night. I don't mean it in the sense that you would not speak to me at all. No, no, I mean that I'm no longer sure if you will allow us to be truthful, if we will ever have our barriers down as we did last night, and the night before that, and on that first night we met 3 years ago. How can I begin to tell you what it meant to meet someone I could talk to, someone I could confess everything to? Do you remember that first week we met, how you came over every night? Teta had no idea. All day I would long for you. My heart would jump when you'd miscall me to let me know you were outside. I'd stand by the dark stairway listening as your footsteps came closer, my stomach in excitable knots. Then, after letting you out, I would get back into bed, stick my head deep into your pillow, and savor the way your smell mixed with Doris's orange blossom laundry detergent. I'd lie there and wish for sleep to come, not just to dream of you, but also to forget you. And although so soon society got in the way and you insisted we see each other less, you remain my days and my nights, my only thought and source of pleasure. In public, I'd watch you walk with ease through a crowded room, and then watch you do the same in my bedroom, naked. You would cross the length of my bedroom, knowing my eyes followed you, hungrily gaping as you strolled to pick something up, seemingly at random, and move it from one side of the room to the other. It was a performance. Inasmuch as your swagger across the vast wedding hall or a crowded bar was a performance. But this performance was only for me. I was your only audience. Only I will see you this way, in here, I tell myself. When Doris came in to clean the room the next day, she would never know that you had been here, naked, your bare feet leaving invisible footprints on the floor.
And again, that's our guest, Salim Haddad, reading from his debut book, a novel called Guapa. I mean, it's a beautiful passage, I have to say. I mean, clearly he's smitten in love with Taimur. But this desire to be truthful, I mean, you can be that he could only feel honest and truthful in the privacy of his bedroom. But out in the world or even outside of that bedroom, he couldn't be truthful.
Mm-hmm. And I think Rasa, you know, and this comes out in the novel, I think over time he wants to expand the area where he can be truthful. And I think that's where the primary conflict with Taimur comes in, is because Taimur, on the other hand, does not want to expand that space. Rasa wants to start to be more open. He wants to start to challenge ideas of how to be in society. And Taimur is content with the room being their only place where they can be themselves.
Have you lived that yourself?
I've lived versions of it, definitely. And, you know, in the Middle East, and especially when you're younger in the Middle East, you don't have the space. And so that was part of my desire to come out, was this realization that actually I did not want to live a life that didn't feel authentic to me. I wanted to own my space, whether public or private. And so it definitely is a part of me.
We don't know what country this is. And I know that's by design.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it just, it doesn't matter what country it is? I mean, it's clearly in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
but we don't know. Is it Syria? Is it Jordan? Is it Kuwait? We don't know.
I think.
And you smile.
I do. Yeah. I do get asked this question a lot. And it's funny because speaking to many Arab readers, I think they understand why I didn't name a country. And I think those who are very familiar with the different Arab countries will pick up where I've sort of taken, you know, an element from here and an element from there, and sort of tried to paint this mosaic that celebrates these Arab cities that, you know, I grew up in and I visit regularly. And I like the fact that it removes the focus from the, you know, a real area and allows me to explore dynamics, allows me to explore relationships, family relationships, social relationships, away from the heaviness of real life Arab politics, which I really didn't want to distract from the story.
So if it had been in Aleppo or someplace like that, then that would have been a distraction to what Rasa is, I guess, going through or realizing about his life.
Exactly.
I'm curious, too, about, and perhaps this is more about you than about Rasa, but we now have in this country marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
Our Supreme Court made that a constitutional right for gay couples. Can you imagine that in an Arab country in your lifetime?
Yeah, I can. What I'm less sure of is how we get there and whether we will take the same path that the U.S. has taken. And I think it's very important that we look to many of these countries where certain laws protecting LGBT rights have been put in place, and we take and we learn what we think is relevant for us, and we don't take the rest.
Yeah.
There have been, you know, great legislative changes in, for example, Lebanon around the recognition of transgender or the right of someone to change their gender identity in January of this year. So we do have certain changes that are happening,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's just happening in a different pace and in a different way.
I'm thinking of those absolutely horrifying scenes. This is ISIS throwing gay men off the tops of buildings, obviously to their death. Now, they've been terrorizing Muslims and a lot of the Muslim population and women and girls and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But since we're talking about being gay in the Middle East and wondering whether there isn't a nostalgia for the dictators when, you know, you sort of knew where you stood, as opposed to these terrorists or ISIS in particular, that obviously wants to terrorize the population.
There definitely is, I think, is a nostalgia for these dictators. But I would really, and this is at the crux of Rasa's political dilemma in the novel, is this idea of, well, were we better off before? And I'm, you know, Rasa comes to his conclusion. But for me, I would caution against this idea that life was better under the dictatorship. The dictatorships, what we're seeing now in terms of the violence is partly driven by years of repression and dictatorship. And this idea that you can, you know, things would be better if we just put the lid back on and turn our eyes, that to me is a false idea.
Hmm.
And I would also question this the choice that is often given to us that we either have to choose between ISIS or Assad. We don't have to make that choice, and there's power in saying, actually, I don't want
either one of them.
I don't want either one of them. And yeah. I think there's an agency and power in saying that.
This book is also, it seems, embedded in it is about class as well. I mean, Rasa comes from not a wealthy family, but certainly a comfortable middle-class family. Mm-hmm. He has a job. He works as a translator. There's some security, financial security he has. That protects him, I guess, to some degree. Certainly protects him as a man, but also as a gay man as well. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
For me, exploring class was very important, and, you know, both for political reasons, but also in terms of understanding the differences with how different social classes in the region also experience their gay identity. Class plays a big part in the amount of protection that you receive. If you're gay or if you're not gay, but it also plays a part into the amount of protection that you have under different regimes. And I think the revolution has allowed Rasa to realize that actually there are many different people from different social classes with very different ideas and very different living standards. Going back to the question around nostalgia and
yes.
nostalgia for dictatorship, I was in southern Turkey, you know, doing interviews with a lot of Syrian activists a few weeks ago. And one thing someone said to me really stuck in my head when she talked about this nostalgia. And she said, you know, she's from a sort of upper middle class. And she said, you know, when I talk to my parents or I talk to my friends and they say, oh, you know, the great days of Bashar al-Assad, I have to remind them that actually during those great days of Bashar al-Assad, 80% of the country were living in absolute poverty. It's just that we were blind to it. They were living under horrible circumstances. The only, like someone in the book says, the only social services they've seen in years is the police thugs who are going into towns to beating them. We have very different ideas about what the history was.
I mean, nostalgia, but also denial, right? I mean,
exactly.
Just not, and perhaps not even knowing what was actually going on mm-hmm. around.
Exactly.
People smoke in this novel, and I have to say they smoke a lot. And not to say that American novels are smoke-free, because certainly people do, but there's just a lot of smoking. Does that say something about you, something about the Middle East? I mean,
well,
it doesn't, you know, it's not illegal to smoke.
I was struggling with quitting smoking while I was writing this book.
Oh, really?
So maybe there's an element of it that was just, instead of me smoking, I had my characters just smoke for me. No, but smoking, I mean, in the Middle East is huge. It's huge and it's everywhere. And it's such a huge part of the culture. And I remember, you know, being a smoker in the Middle East, it was just a way to take out your frustrations with everything that was happening around you. But also, it was a way to celebrate, you know. You just felt like... Life is short.
Cigarette.
Yeah, life is short. Let's have a drink and a cigarette.
So are you a non-smoker now, or how
yeah.
did that work?
I'm a vapor now.
Oh, you vape? Oh.
Yeah.
What's that? I'm an ex-smoker. It's
oh,
been
right.
many,
okay.
many years. So
okay.
does vaping give you the same little kick that nicotine does?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
It's something to do with your hands?
Yeah, it's something to do with your hands. And I think there's something also in the idea of smoking. There's an element of just, for me at least, this weight off my shoulders where I just feel like, you know, I have this moment to myself, and vaping doesn't do that. But, you know, it's made me healthier. I can go for longer runs. I can, you know, work out better. So
I think people listening would say you don't sound like you come either from the Middle East or the UK where you live now.
Mm-hmm.
There's something sort of American-ish about the way you speak.
I say it's my TV American accent.
Is that what it is?
It's growing up watching a lot of American television because I mean, I moved around a lot as a kid, and TV was one of the few constants in my life. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, my friends growing up were people on television shows that followed me around in the different countries that I went to. And it was an escape for me, and books were an escape for me, and especially English books.
Like your character in here.
Exactly.
I mean, he falls in love with reading when he's in America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. And I mean, I think Rasa falls in love with a different type of reading. I grew up reading novels, and then it wasn't really until university where I got into political theory and that sort of thing. And it was partly a response to try and understand this Arabness that we talked about, this idea of what is this Arab identity after 9/11? How was it constructed?
What were the TV shows that you liked as a kid growing up?
What did I like?
You mentioned Blossom in this novel.
I loved Blossom, but Blossom was also very interesting to me because it was so rare to actually come across an episode. So it held, you know, I had this reverence for the show. So when I would catch it, either at friends' places or, you know, people who had certain channels, I would be mesmerized. Yes, so Blossom was huge for me. Party of Five.
Oh.
And Party of Five, you know, when I was a bit older, I really loved Party of Five and My So-Called Life. Degrassi Junior High, which is a Canadian show, but we used to watch that. And also I used to watch The Bold and the Beautiful with my grandmother.
Oh, there you go.
So I have around, you know, 7 years of The Bold and the Beautiful in my mind.
Which explains some degree how you sound, right?
Exactly.
Was this hard to write? I mean, this is your first novel. Was it hard for you to write this?
It was hard to write, especially in the beginning, because, you know, I had never seen positive representations of gay people or of gay Arabs anywhere, really. So I didn't have a template to start with. And so in many ways, I was just curating and picking out these different elements that I, you know, from my favorite books and TV shows and movies. And there was also, it was also difficult because I wasn't sure how to talk about these very sensitive and complex issues and how to speak to two different audiences, an Arab audience and a Western audience, and give both the respect that, you know, the story requires. But I think at some point I just absolved myself of the need to speak on behalf of any one community.
Speak for yourself, right?
Exactly. And I think once I realized that and I just said, I'm just going to tell my truth or the truth that I know, I began to write, and this sort of, and then it just flowed after that.
We're almost out of time. Has it been translated? Has it been, as you said, your grandmother hasn't read it, but has it been read, has it been translated into Arabic?
Not yet, no, but it's something that I'm working on. It's available in many Arab cities and bookstores in Jordan and Lebanon and the West Bank, as far as I know. And so I hope to get it translated into Arabic soon. That would be my dream.
Well, Salim Adan, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, our guest, Salim Haddad, his novel, his first book is called Guapa. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. Download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you.